This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Snapshots from the past few bloody weeks in Iraq. The charred, mutilated bodies of civilian workers dragged through the streets of Fallujah. A United States Marine hoisting the body bag containing a fallen comrade over his shoulder. The frightened face of a young Army reservist surrounded by masked kidnappers. By its nature, war is a gruesome business, and obviously there's a great deal we do not see, either because photographers weren't there or because editors decide that some pictures are simply too graphic. American media are frequently criticized for sanitizing the war in Iraq, and when pictures like those just described are published and broadcast, there are also complaints of sensationalism. Where's the line? What's the value of these gruesome images? Do they belong on the front page and on the nightly news? Later in the program, The Forgotten Genius, the strange, brilliant, and contentious life of Robert Hooke, but first, images of war. If you've seen some of these pictures, call and tell us your reaction. Are they just published to sell papers or grab ratings, or is this part of the truth of war that needs to be seen? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. The Chicago Tribune ran one of the more shocking photographs of the Fallujah incident on its front page. George DeLama is deputy managing editor at the Chicago Tribune and was involved in the decision to run the photo. He joins us by phone from his office in Chicago, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Take us back to that day. Once the photos came in from the Associated Press, what happened?
Well, they came in. They started to come in the mid-afternoon, and we were alerted by some of the editors on the photo desk that before our 4 o'clock page one meeting that we're going to have a serious decision to make about what kind of images we wanted to use that night. So we began an informal conversation there that wound up ranging for about 4 or 5 hours.
How many people were involved?
Well, at various times anywhere from 4 to about 18 people at one point. But it was a long, intermittent, open-ended conversation among a broad range of editors. We called in a couple of experienced correspondents who had spent a lot of time in the Middle East. We even talked to colleagues at some other newspapers. They asked them what they were going to do. That was a tough day at newspapers across the country.
Indeed. Newspapers are not a democracy, but was there a vote, a consensus? What happened to make the final decision?
Well, that day, the managing editor, Jim O'Shea, he was in charge, and he finally made the decision. But we did have a consensus, and this doesn't happen very often on very controversial matters, but that day it was pretty much unanimous of everybody here that we just felt compelled at the end of the day that we needed to display that picture to really represent what happened in Fallujah that day. It was such an extraordinary day.
You ran that picture on the front page. A lot of other newspapers ran the picture on the inside of the newspaper. Why page one? Wouldn't the inside just be as effective with the possibility of perhaps offending fewer of your readers?
Well, we don't set out to ruin our readers' breakfast, and these decisions shouldn't be easy, and this one wasn't easy. But the decisive factor for us is that was the lead story of the day, and the picture told the story. In a sense, the picture was a story, and it communicated more clearly than even the words in the story could have what the hatred and contempt that the United States was facing in Fallujah, which made this such an infamous event. It also had for us echoes of Somalia, when body of a U.S. serviceman is dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. In that conflict, those images presented to the American people helped lead to a decisive point in American troops leaving Somalia. Now, we didn't think that this would happen here and the consequences we would leave for later, but it just seemed to us that this was just a momentous time in this conflict, and we needed to represent it fully.
What's been the reaction of your readership?
It's been mixed. I think most readers, to be fair, were upset with us for publishing the picture. They thought the story itself would do. Some of the complaints were that it would be disrespectful and hurtful to the victims' families, that it could traumatize young children. Those considerations we take seriously. But at the end of the day, we thought that we had to show this picture, that it would have been worse for us to not show this picture, because this is what happened that day. And these were the images also that were all over television that day and that people all over the rest of the world saw.
I wonder, some of the television broadcasters decided to fuzz up the images a little bit to maybe take the edge off of the gruesomeness. Obviously, that's available technologically these days to newspaper publishers as well. Is that something you considered?
No, because we have rules against that. When we show a news photograph, we don't doctor the photo in any way. Now, the picture we use, you never did describe it, it's the picture of the charred remains, the two of them hanging from the bridge with people in Fallujah celebrating in the foreground. There were other pictures that were more gruesome that we chose not to use. One of the considerations that went into our decision is, in truth, the bodies weren't even identifiable as human by that point, by the time, unless you told readers what they were and they knew what to look for. But there were other pictures that were much more gruesome of the bodies being mutilated, which we did not show.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Patrick, who's with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I've got real conflicting feelings about this. I'm a former Marine that fought in Vietnam and went to Vietnam very patriotic, and I came home, became a pacifist, and now I'm not sure where I am. But what I really want the American people to do is understand the horrible reality of war. And so I think we need to know, we need to see the pictures of war. We need to know how brutal and horrible it is. I thought these pictures in particular were pretty sensational, but let us see it. Let the people know this is what happens over there. This is what they do to us. This is what we do to them. This is what happens in war.
George DeLama, was that part of your consideration?
Well, and also, yes, I mean, this is what war is. And I think people in other countries are used to seeing far more of this, particularly in nations where people have more experience with conflict. They're used to seeing far more of this than Americans are. In the Middle East, for instance, the Arab world watches Al Jazeera, and they show scenes like these and of dead Iraqis that have been killed by U.S. troops. People see these scenes and scenes in Israel every day. Americans rarely see scenes like that. I think that helps explain a little bit of the gulf in views in different parts of the world of the United States and its actions. Also, we don't do this very often. We do this only in extraordinary circumstances. And in this case, we decided this is one of those circumstances, one of those days that fit that definition. And by doing it, I think some of our readers told us, we know you don't do it very often, so this was extraordinary.
Patrick, thanks very much.
You betcha.
Okay. And George DeLama, before we let you go, you described a four-hour editorial meeting, a lot of people debating back and forth before a consensus was reached, a decision was finally made. I wonder if you have any empathy with cable news outlets, for example, where the decision time is rarely so long.
Oh, absolutely. And also, these decisions are made every day. We're talking about this day because you did see these pictures in some newspapers, but we have pictures that come in every single day. The circumstances are not always so extraordinary, but we have to do the best we can every day on its merits.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
George DeLama is Deputy Managing Editor for the Chicago Tribune. He was with us by phone from his office in Chicago. And here with us now in Studio 3A is Kenneth Irby. He's Visual Journalism Leader for the Poynter Institute. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be here.
We just heard from the Deputy Managing Editor of the Chicago Trib, who ran those graphic pictures, or one of them, from Fallujah. And as he pointed out, not the most graphic one. What did some other newspapers do?
There were, as George alluded to, there were several. This was unlike Somalia, where there was one decisive moment taken by Paul Watson. There were at least 15 photographers in the area, and five international news agencies distributed a range of pictures. So there were many alternatives, and I like to encourage news organizations to consider the alternatives. There were, in fact, some very, very gruesome images that showed partially identifiable bodies still burning. I'm thinking back to, there was one photograph that just showed the two hands of one of the four victims just engulfed in flames. And there were other pictures that showed the mutilation of the charred remains as well.
And some newspapers ran them on the front page, and you tend to think, would those have been in the larger markets, New York, Chicago?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The New York Times also ran the picture that you're referring to, that
the bodies hanging from the bridge.
And there were two versions of that. That was the Associated Press version. But the EPA group also ran shared a version of that picture. But most papers, it's interesting, across the country, as I've looked at several hundred editions, and just leaving the ASNE meeting, there were the American Society of Newspaper Editors,
right,
had a whole series, a whole wall full of front pages that are shared courtesy of the museum. And that corroborated my challenge that most organizations either ran the bridge version or a more sedate version that just showed the car burning in the background and Iraqis celebrating in the foreground.
Some newspapers also ran them on the front page, many inside the newspapers.
Absolutely. Many ran the most controversial image on the inside of the newspaper. And there were actually two papers, the Arizona Daily Star, that published on its front page the picture that I described of just the two hands of a victim in the flames, and then the Lakeland Ledger also ran a version down in Lakeland, Florida, ran a version where you could see a body in the foreground in the flames and the Jeep in the background.
Not too many years ago, the newspaper or whatever we saw on the nightly news was going to be our only opportunity to see whatever there was to see. These days, of course, anybody who wants to see those images can certainly find them on the Internet. How does that play into people's decisions?
Absolutely. I mean, I think as we've heard time and time again, there's a competition factor and there's an alternative factor. The New York Times, in fact, was the first organization to publish several different variations of the Fallujah atrocities on their website. And then CNN and Fox and your other cable networks were also going live early with some level of restraint by the anchor sharing with the viewing audience that the pictures that would be following the lead-ins were pretty gruesome and to prepare them for that.
Mm-hmm. How did television tend to handle it? And again, I guess there's a distinction between the cable news outlets, you know, Fox, CNN, and those people who are MSNBC, who are reacting instantly, and the people have a longer time to make their decisions.
Well, I think it's a really interesting comparison. Most TV stations practiced measured restraint as well in terms of how they went about airing the footage in Florida, where I reside. Most organizations by 6 o'clock, again, had some kind of early lead-in or advisory disclosure statement that you know, offered some warning, and they pretty much shared very, very edited versions that pretty much showed the overall area, showing the burning vehicles and the celebration that ensued, but not the more graphic imagery of the bodies.
And again, some of them, I believe, were pixelated, fuzzed up electronically.
I didn't see any of that. I saw that on cable, but not on
the
local
cable
affiliates.
Yes,
right.
Yeah, on cable, some of the pictures were fuzzed up.
Absolutely.
A little bit. I wondered, what did you make of George Stalama's assertion about they have a rule there at his newspaper: if you're going to publish, publish.
Well, I agree with that rule, but I would refer to it as a guideline. I think rules box us into places where we can never move outside of the rule. We can't break the rule. And so many newsrooms actually found themselves faced with a challenge because they had the serial test rule where that you don't upset the Cheerios that a reader or viewer are engaging in the morning, or the rule that what if my child ever saw this, or the rule that is very common in American newsrooms that we never show bodies. The no body bag rule, as it's often referred to. I like the fact that their process was one of inclusion, where there were several different voices contributing to the discussion, and they actually sought out some non-traditional voices for input.
We're talking about the value and purpose of publishing war images with the Poynter Institute's Kenny Irby. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255 or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This past month in particular has brought some brutal images of war out of Iraq. Today we're discussing the ethical issues involved in publishing graphic pictures of war, broadcasting them as well. Our guest is Kenny Irby, who runs the photojournalism program at the Poynter Institute. Of course, we want to hear your reactions as well. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Keith, who joins us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes, I've found that it's would be very important to have images of the civilians and particularly the children who have been killed in this conflict and in past conflicts. And well, I have a project where it's called foodnotbombs.net, where I post the images of the children that have been killed in Fallujah, some of them that are actually broadcast on other, on TV and in newspapers around the world.
But rarely here, Kenny. And is that part of the rule you were talking about before that many newspapers have about no bodies? Or, as Keith is implying, is there something else at work here?
Yeah, Neil. The American newspaper media and print and broadcast as well have another rule that we haven't talked about, and that's kind of the exotic rule. Or some variation of a rule that allows the publishing of victims of atrocities from far away. But the real challenge in this case we have to face is that these were American citizens. And this was one of the first time that we had that kind of imagery available to us in a real-time way. And so newsrooms really agonized over what if this were a member of our neighborhood or our community or our readership or viewership area, unlike as the caller is referring to, when oftentimes they're bodies that are of far-off lands.
Mm-hmm. Let me put it this way. There's an email we get from Sebastian Schiavone. Why is it okay to display the destroyed bodies of Saddam's sons when they were killed and not okay to show the dead American bodies killed in Fallujah? Why are Americans so blind to double standards they themselves so willingly and proudly create?
I concur with that writer who has shared that email. I think we have to think about the balance of our presentation and how we respect a life wherever it is and whomever they may be.
Let's talk now with Cedar, who's on the line with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professor of art, and so I come at this from a visual arts perspective, and there's a rich history of the arts depicting war over the ages. And one thing that history, I think, has shown us is that it's almost never neutral. Depictions of war always have an agenda that become revealed more as we get a little further away from them. But my direct take on this is that I'm opposed to this war, and I find it to be an extremely cynical war. However, I find myself somewhat attracted to the images. And that's made me think about this. And what I've noticed with my students in the classroom, when they have access to the Internet, the naughty ones will go to websites that depict naked people in sexual connotations, or they will go to websites that depict carnage or mutilated bodies of the sort that we're seeing now from Fallujah. I found this revealing as to the sort of scopophilic and pornographic nature of these images. So I think I'm glad that the images are out there, because I think that a sanitized war, such as we saw in the last Gulf War, is ultimately more dangerous for society than for a war that is depicted directly.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that we need to be suspicious of our fondness for these images, and also suspicious of the idea of any kind of balance or neutrality, because there's always an agenda there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not suggesting that we can be completely neutral, but I think we can be, and the media is required to be balanced in that it shares a range of experiences and perspectives. The one distinction that I think has to be made is that, and I think you understand this, but for all of our other listeners, is that the photography that newspapers engage in sharing is not art. It is journalistic content with the purpose of honestly and truthfully portraying the realities of an experience, as one of our earlier callers called in about the horrors of war. I think the other aspect here is that we have to also always be mindful that while the primary purpose of journalism is to maximize truth-telling, there is some balance, if you will, of minimizing harm. And that's why we saw such a range of different approaches, mm-hmm. with different groups of journalists making decisions, very difficult decisions, about how to air and to publish those pictures.
And as you suggested, decisions that were not taken lightly, as we heard from Chicago. But what about Cedar's other point about there's always an agenda? The argument of American officials briefing in Baghdad sometimes, as you see these images on some of the Arab news outlets, and they're saying clearly they have an agenda that is opposed to the war. They focus on civilian casualties. Could the same argument be made on the other side of politics, perhaps, about American media?
Oh, absolutely. And I think we have to protect that assertion being made and allowing it to stick. And that's why the balance is so important, to show the victims on both sides of the war, which is why it was important to have unilaterals as well as embed journalists who were able to witness and report those experiences in the breadth of their coverage.
Cedar, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Okay. One other thing that Cedar's reference there is that I do think that taste is changing. All of the traditional cereal tests, breakfast tests, what if my child saw this test, were, you know, come out of a very provincial, early, you know, period in America when we did sanitize the news, and we weren't as acknowledging of the visual literacy in our society. And now, if people really want to see those pictures, they can go to the internet, or they can go to their DirecTV and expose the truth that's out there.
Email question from Elizabeth in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Why is it that viewing mutilation, war, and death is okay in mainstream entertainment, such as the opening sequences of Cold Mountain or Saving Private Ryan, but if it's not fiction, editors perceive that it's inappropriate? Why isn't it okay to view similar images when they're real?
What a wonderful confirmation of my previous point just now. I think we do have to acknowledge that in our popular society, both in television and video games and cinematography, we are exposed to a concept of media violence and media trauma in ways that have changed, I think, viewer and reader patterns.
And would you be surprised at all if the bar were lowered a little bit as conflict continues, as we become more accustomed to images such as those from Fallujah?
Well, that's a matter of perspective, whether it's lowered or raised. But I do think that the fact that we would reveal more of the realities of the horrors of war is a good thing in the grand scheme of our purpose in American society, and I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more images of this kind as the war or this conflict continues to unfold.
Kenny Irby, thanks very much for being with us today. Kenny Irby is visual journalism group leader for the Poynter Institute. He joined us here in Studio 3A. And with us now from his office in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Louisiana State University Professor David Perlmutter. He's the author of the books Photojournalism and Foreign Policy and Visions of War, Picturing Warfare from the Stone Age to the Cyber Age. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Give us some historical background. When was it that war images first appeared?
Well, we go back to the cave paintings of the Stone Ages 10, 15,000 years ago, and there are pictures of violence there, mostly violence of humans against animals. You have to get into the New Stone Age, the Neolithic, about 5, 6, 7,000 years ago, that you first begin to get pictures of groups of human beings having battles with other groups of human beings. And what's interesting is almost immediately some of the issues that you've just been talking about, that is a country we're talking about, are raised. These are not objective reports, reporting from you know, showing both sides. These are often very biased images. Obviously, the person who painted the image on the side of a rock or on the wall of a cave was rooting for one side or another. And we can see a lot of these things come from the very beginning then.
So what did they look like? I mean, obviously you're saying hooray for our side, but what did they actually look like?
Well, you can see, for example, one side trouncing the other. You can see things like one of the interesting things about the history of war images is you can show I'm a historian of war images, but I can take pretty much any war image created up to the age of photography and show it to a group of school children and ask them the question, who's the warlord, who's the king, who's the most important guy in this picture? And they'll be able to point him out, even if it's a Mayan image or a cave painting. Why? Because that's probably the guy who was
requisitioning the picture.
Mm-hmm.
The guy, the tribal chief, he's bigger, you know, he's more muscular, he's carrying more weapons, he's leading the troops in the battle. You could look at these pictures and sort of be an instant war historian.
And you could see that Babylonian times, ancient Egyptian times, all the hieroglyphics, that's very evident.
Right. And what was interesting is that the horrors of war back then were boasts. If you look at the Assyrian images of war, the Egyptian, of those ancient civilizations, they pictured the destruction of cities and cutting people up into small pieces and murdering civilians as, hey, this is, we're bad, this is what we do, and we're proud of this. This is our great accomplishment. So that was the origins of horrors of war were in boasting of how great we are at the horrors of war.
And when you enter the image of photography, of course, you're talking about the American Civil War.
Yes. Photography is invented 1840s, 1850s. First war photographed was the Crimean War, which was between the alliance of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, Britain and France fought against Russia and the Crimean. There are some pictures of those which are taken and then published in the London Illustrated News. Mostly they're soldiers sitting around eating lunch and generals posing, and then some pictures of rubble. For most of the 19th century, the technology did not allow pictures of action. You had to sit still for a couple of minutes. That's why you have so many static pictures. Civil War, we do get photographers loading up their giant wagons and their metal and glass plates and traveling to the battlefield, and they're coming back with pictures of the dead from a battlefield, with pictures of the rubble from a battlefield, and also the sort of soldiers having lunch and generals posing proudly pictures. However, the technology did not exist for those pictures to go directly into the newspapers. The halftone had not, the little dots, mm-hmm. if you look closely at a newspage, had not been invented yet as a process. So what newspapers did was they had somebody turn those photographs into an etching. And right away, there was manipulation and editing. For example, a photographer taking a picture of the battlefield of Antietam or something would say, you know, that corpse would look better over here. And it would really look better if there was a gun next to that corpse, and his hat should be moved a little bit to the side. And then the same process would occur in the creation of the etching, where somebody might, for example, as happened now with the images from Fallujah, clean things up, you know, remove some of the more gruesome wounds or the such. So these are, for a war historian anyway, these are very old issues.
And what about the effect of these pictures and these images, particularly the shocking effect that we read about people in galleries in New York going to see those pictures from Antietam and seeing dead soldiers?
Yeah, you know, there was a famous quote from a romantic painter of war, because most people had seen war in oil paintings up until that time, where things were really sort of cleaned up, romanticized. Everybody died a glorious death after being shot in the, you know, discreetly in the chest. And the painter said, "Who will look at essentially my paintings now? That now that you see the grisly black and white." Forensically detailed photos of war, who can go back and look at a romantic picture of war and take it seriously?
We're speaking with David Perlmutter. His books include Photojournalism and Foreign Policy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Owen, who's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a quick question for you. Basically, this war, I think, of any that I've in part two, as far as looking at the media goes, seems the most sanitized for the amount of death that has occurred. So my question is, how does the press's access differ from administration to administration in the White House?
Well, I guess it depends on what you define as sanitized. I mean, World War One, for example, photography was simply banned of anything that generals didn't like, and, for example, you couldn't show any American. Home front audiences in World War One, unless they heard the story from somebody coming home from the battlefield, saw nothing of what we consider to be World War One, the trenches, the bodies, the misery, the artillery, the machine guns. They didn't see any of that, so that was total censorship. World War Two, it was more of a cooperative censorship. The press was considered to be part of the war effort, so it was just taken as natural, for example, that you wouldn't show the body of a dead American soldier.
And I don't think the first dead American was shown until the Battle of Taro, in 1943?
That's right. And even then, you know, can't show a face, maybe a pool of blood. So it was just changing slightly But again, it was a sort of the press are part of the war effort. It wasn't. It was censorship, but I don't think a lot of photojournalists really chafing at it. Vietnam, you have an evolution there. Part of it was the fact that Vietnam lasted so much longer. So, at first, if you look at the early photography, news photography in Vietnam, it looks very much like World War II. But I think at some point, you know, Americans started being involved in Vietnam late 50s. The press was getting tired of the same pictures, and they were watching American soldiers dying. We weren't marching to Berlin or island hopping to Japan. It became pretty clear by 67 that, you know, we didn't really have a strategy for victory except sort of the prevent defense.
Or attrition, I think it was called, but yeah.
Yeah, you begin to have a change there, and you begin to see more. And there's a whole question of control. The control had sort of slipped away, and pictures that would have never been published in previous wars were getting through.
But what about... Okay, Owen, thanks very much. But what about his point about, sanitization compared to Gulf War I or back in 91? Is this war more or less sanitized?
I think the key issue was that people like Schwarzkopf and Powell were of the Vietnam generation of military leaders who came out of Vietnam saying, you know what, we won the war militarily. A lot think that, and I think there's a debate among military historians about that. But we lost the war in the media, and we can't fight a war unless we figure out a way to win the war in the media. And the Gulf War was sort of a classic example of them saying, well, we're going to combine restrictions about where the press can go with, I think, a very clever strategy of flooding the media with pictures of their own creation. You remember Norman Schwarzkopf standing there at the TV monitor, and here's the office of my predecessor, and here's the cruise missile or the laser-guided bomb going through his window. That was great stuff. That was great television. And that was the point, is that they figured out, let's use the images we want to be in the news stream. And so different sanitization.
There's another point, though, and very briefly, because we have to go to a break, but in the first part of the Gulf War I and then Kosovo, it was an air war, often difficult to get pictures.
Yeah, that's right. Although, you know, there were people on the ground who the bombs were falling on who were producing pictures. We were just choosing not to publish those pictures.
A lot of those pictures were broadcast to people from Baghdad and that sort of thing. We certainly do remember that. But different kinds of conflicts create different kinds of situations. Anyway, we're going to continue our conversation with David Perlmutter when we come back from a short break. Again, if you'd like to join us, our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Also, no portraits survive. Few know his name, but Robert Hooke was amongst the greatest minds of the 17th century. His story also when we return from the break. If you have questions about Robert Hooke, in fact, if you know his name, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing images of war. David Perlmutter is a professor at Louisiana State University, a senior fellow at the Riley Center for Media and Public Affairs, and the author of a number of books on the subject of war images. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Mark, who's with us from Warrenton, Mississippi. Hi, Mark.
Warrenton, Missouri.
Missouri, MS. My mistake. I made a mistake. Bye-bye. Hello, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question would be, how much sooner would we have come into war had we been seeing images of the 300,000 some odd that are generally accepted to have been killed in the last 20 years? Saddam Hussein is, you could certainly say that he's a creation of our own making, and we hold responsibility, or we should take some responsibility for him being in power for as long as he has. I would also add that it took us until December of 1941 to enter World War II, and we entered against Japan after God only knows how many millions died in Europe. And we came in as an ally of Stalin, who was killing his own people by the millions. If the press had been there showing us what a monster Stalin was, would we have been his ally, and would we have sat on the sidelines for as long as we did?
He's speaking a lot about the power of imagery and what we don't see.
Yeah, one of the powers of pictures, obviously, is to define reality. There are some 40 to 50 wars going on in the world right now. I probably could only name about 10 to 12, and it's my area of study. Most people only know a couple. And frankly, there are some places you can't go to cover a war. And so, well, what I guess those people don't count, or they don't exist. They certainly don't in terms of national policy quite often. This is a real issue. The caller mentioned World War II. I point out to my students how we have to always keep in mind when we're talking about the horrors of war that horror, as well as sympathy and empathy, are in the mind of the beholder. We have images, for example, of the Holocaust. Those images were created by the people who perpetrated the Holocaust. They did not see those images as evidence of man's humanity to man, or the horrors of war. They saw them as trophy photos, souvenir snapshots, or bureaucratic minutiae. So that's something that's very important. Right now, I may look at the images from Fallujah of the dead American contractors, and I may be revolted by that, but as you've reported on NPR, there are many people, for example, in Iraq and in the Arab world, who may look at them and dance with delight. So we have to be very careful when we say, there's images out there, and those images are what's going on in the world today. Frankly, almost the opposite is true, and I guess it's part of our job as citizens in a cyber democracy, where there are other sources of information out there, to try to find out, what's going on that's not on the news tonight.
Mark, thanks very much.
One point real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder if the lack of those images in these 40 conflicts that are going on around the world is maybe a subtle attempt to keep us from really thinking about it very hard, in a way keeping us out of those conflicts. And then when we do get involved in them, we start seeing the images, because they're certainly closer to home. They involve Americans. And those images are used, frankly, to get us out of these conflicts maybe earlier than we should.
Or
leave it at that.
Or, Mark, I would raise the point in sometimes, and thanks very much for the call, in terms of the CNN factor, it was called, when starving Kurdish children after the first Gulf War were shown, and U.S. forces, the president, who did not particularly want to intervene in that situation, felt forced to.
Yes, and on the other hand, presidents can refer to images as examples of why to get involved in war. Images in the press are politicized. They're politicized by practically everybody, the people who create them, and all the other power players in politics. So it's very hard for me to say, we would have some ideal world where we have only neutral pictures. Pictures show, a good picture will show what's in front of the camera, but after that, there's a big battle to define what a picture really means, from the base level of how to caption it.
David Perlmutter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Perlmutter is a professor at Louisiana State University. His books include Photojournalism and Foreign Policy and Visions of War, Picturing Warfare from the Stone Age to the Cyber Age. He joined us from his office in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.